If you'd like to learn more about the topics of this episode or any previous episode, visit the Nature's Secret Service website at naturessecretservice.com and click on All Episodes. As always, thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature's Secret Service, and I'm your host, Ed Newcomer. Welcome to the final episode of Season 1 of Nature's Secret Service. So far, you've had the opportunity to be in the room for my conversations with some of the best federal and state wildlife officers in the business. Believe me, there's more to come. A few of you have asked, "Hey, Ed the Fed, what about your stories?" Well, you're in luck, because the guests I had scheduled for the season finale had to cancel at the last minute. However, I recently appeared on the podcast Zone 7 to discuss two of my cases, including one that I've never talked about publicly before. Cheryl McCollum, the host of Zone 7, has generously given me permission to replay that episode here on the Nature's Secret Service channel. If you're interested in true crime, I encourage you to tune in and subscribe to Zone 7. Cheryl is a law enforcement forensics professional who knows her stuff and who has some great guests on her show. Look for Zone 7 on iHeartRadio or wherever you get your podcasts. Nature's Secret Service will be back for Season 2 with more episodes and more great guests. In the meantime, enjoy your summer, binge our first season again, and watch for bonus episode shorts we'll be releasing during the break. If you haven't done so already, please go to the Nature's Secret Service website, scroll to the bottom of the main page, and get signed up as a subscriber. By doing so, you'll get email reminders about our bonus episodes and about the premiere of Season 2. I promise we won't sell your information and we won't clog your inbox with spam. Our emails will come from contact@naturessecretservice.com, so make sure you enter that into your address book so our emails don't end up in your spam folder. Thanks for being one of my listeners. I'm really glad you're enjoying these stories as much as I am. Now, here's my May 21st appearance on Zone 7 with Cheryl McCollum.
You're listening to an iHeart podcast.
Tonight, we have such a unique and just incredible guest. I am certain that y'all have no understanding of what his job was, so we're going to get right to it. Tonight, we have Special Agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He served for over 20 years. Ed Newcomer worked in Los Angeles. He did a variety of international posts. He retired in 2022, but y'all, during his career, he conducted some high-profile international wildlife trafficking investigations. These investigations involved every continent. He even went to Antarctica.
Hey everyone, Ed here, cutting in with a quick correction. I never personally traveled to Antarctica. If you read my bio on the web, you'll see that it says that I worked on wildlife trafficking cases during my career involving every continent, including Antarctica. Cheryl misunderstood that meant that I'd actually traveled there. Actually, I conducted an investigation that involved the illegal sale of whale meat here in Los Angeles, and it turned out that whale meat had come from whales harvested from Antarctica. That will be part of a future episode because it's connected in with that television show, Whale Wars. All right, quick correction, back to the show. Thanks.
Okay, he was not playing when it came to investigating some of the most notorious wildlife criminals that are out there. Most of y'all may not understand just how these crimes occur and the organized criminal element that's involved. He is the recipient of the Humane Law Enforcement Award from the Humane Society of the United States. He has a record of 6 law enforcement awards from the U.S. Attorney General's Office of Los Angeles. You can see him talk about his work on several documentaries, including Prime's Bug Out, A&E Undercover, Caught on Tape, and Animal Planet's Animal Black Ops. Ed currently serves as the International Law Enforcement Advisor for the Wildlife Investigators Training Alliance. Ed is also the host of a hit crime podcast focusing on wildlife crime called Nature's Secret Service. Ed Newcomer, welcome to Zone 7.
Mac, thank you so much for having me. I am a huge fan of you and your show. I'm just so honored to be here, and that was a very generous introduction, so thank you very much.
Well, you are mighty welcome, but you know, we both know I left a lot out. You've gotten a lot of awards. You served as an ambassador to animals. You are somebody that law enforcement, prosecutors, the public, all just respect, and we appreciate the work you have done.
Well, thank you. You know what? I got to say, I had a blast. I had the greatest job on the planet, and I loved it. And honestly, I think all the success that I had in my career can be chalked up to just trying to keep up with my colleagues and meet the high bar that they were all setting around me.
Amen. Well, you know, you and I have been able to talk on the phone. And one evening we were talking about undercover work and the danger and special ops and all that. When I hung up, my husband said, "Who was that? What kind of special ops?" And I was like, "Man, he was doing some undercover work on bugs." And Walt was like, "Is that code for something?" I said, "No, I literally mean bugs." And, you know, it's something that people, I don't think, really understand. And one of the conversations you and I talked about was a theft that was done at a bug emporium, a museum in Philly, and it was like nobody really knew about it. Nobody was really talking about it. But when I started researching it, because I wanted to do an article for Crime Online, I'm like, there are these bugs like that are so rare that somebody had to have had inside information to know they were at this museum. And there were things like the 8-eyed spider. And you and I just talked about, you know, your average police officer, if they were to pull somebody over with hiss and cockroaches, they don't want to fool with them. They're just going to say, "Have a good day. Be on your way." I don't think it would dawn on them that these creatures could be being trafficked or harmed in some way or being sold on the black market.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think that a lot of people, when they hear about it, if they do hear about it, they assume that it's, you know, like a maybe a hobbyist that's gone rogue or an animal lover who just got a little carried away. But in reality, you know, these animals can be worth a lot of money, including insects, fish, reptiles, mammals. And so the people that are involved in criminal activity related to animals, they are just criminals. They're in it for the money. And there's a lot of money to be had if you know what you're doing.
That's right. How did you get into this business? Like, what drove you to look at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service?
Yeah, it was actually really kind of a lucky happenstance, honestly. From time I was a kid, I wanted to be in law enforcement. I was always interested in that type of career, or, you know, public service in particular, related to kind of doing the right thing. And, you know, for a long time as a really young kid, I thought, oh, I'll be a police officer someday. And then, I don't know, at some point in my life, I realized there was such a thing as a game warden. And I thought, oh, police for wildlife, that sounds kind of cool. Because I grew up in Denver and near the Rockies, and my family always instilled a very high appreciation for the natural world and wildlife, you know, among all of us. And then really, I went to college at the University of Colorado, and I was majoring in political science, thinking I was going to go on to law school. And, you know, that would give me a lot of opportunities to pursue a lot of different, you know, public service, law enforcement oriented careers. And I just made a shortcut through the biology building to get to my classroom that I needed to go to. And I just happened to look at the bulletin board and I saw there was a job announcement for special agent for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And it kind of stopped me in my tracks. And I read about it and I was like, I didn't even know this, you know, position existed. But as I read about it, I thought, shoot, these guys and gals are the FBI agents for wildlife crime. And that is exactly what I want to do. And so I kind of, you know, I went on and went to law school, but as soon as they had their first opening for special agents after I graduated from law school, I put my application in for sure. I didn't get hired right away because most people don't, but I kept at it. And I accidentally practiced law for 10 years because it took me about 10 years to get the attention of the Fish and Wildlife Service, get that interview and get in.
Wow. What a perfect pairing. I mean, you already love nature. You already love being outdoors. And now you've got this solid decade of, you know, legal training. I mean, what a gift you were to them.
Well, I didn't realize what a benefit it would be to have been, trained as a lawyer, but also most of my career as a lawyer during that 10 years was as a prosecutor. And so, you know, I understood what prosecutors needed when they were preparing a criminal case for trial. So it made it easy for me to, as I was conducting investigations as a federal agent, it made it easy for me to kind of look ahead and say, okay, I know what questions the prosecutor is going to ask me when I bring this case to them, and I know what they're going to want if we're going to go to trial and win.
Well, I've already said it, but you have worked some of the most notable cases with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but you started off with an unexpected bang, didn't you?
you know, I did, and it wasn't the one I wanted, and it wasn't the one I expected, because, you know, honestly, when you become a special agent for the Fish and Wildlife Service, there's 25 plus federal wildlife laws that we enforce, plus we can enforce the entire Title 18 criminal code. But, you know, you're thinking, you come on, you're a federal agent, you're working, you know, you're going to be working on international wildlife trafficking, especially because right out of the academy, I was sent to Los Angeles, and Los Angeles, New York, Miami are the huge, you know, field offices that handle most of the international trafficking cases. So you go there and you think, oh boy, I can't wait for my first case involving a tiger, right? But no, really the first big case I was assigned to on my own was involved a kind of notorious insect trafficker. and I kind of was like, oh my gosh, I don't want this bug case, you know? But as I kind of dug into it, basically the way it started is we got a tip from another agent in a field office in Texas. He had received information from a possible informant that this wanted kind of notorious insect trafficker was going to be at this huge event in Los Angeles called the Insect Fair or the Bug Fair. And so my boss was like, hey, Ed, you know, you're new. Why don't you go down to the Bug Fair, manage this informant? He's going to try to make some contact with this guy. And the more I looked into it, I realized, you know, I found some old case reports from a previous agent who had retired, who had looked at this subject, and this guy was a bad dude. He was going into national parks all over the country, basically poaching butterflies in particular, but beetles as well, from our national parks, packaging them up and shipping them overseas where he would sell them for huge profits. And so, you know, I'm looking at the case reports and I see that this other agent had spent a lot of, you know, legwork and time trying to get this guy. And by the way, the guy's name is Yoshi Kojima. He's a Japanese national. And this other agent just, you know, was so close. He was always just like, a hair's breadth away from catching Yoshi. But he just couldn't get him. And ultimately, a great agent named John Mendoza, unfortunately, his supervisory chain of command told him, hey, you got to close this case. We're spending too much time on it. It's a bug case. There's nothing to it. We're not. And he very, you know, reluctantly closed his case down. And then a few years later, boom, we get this tip that Kojima's kind of back in business. He's back in the States. He's going to be at this huge insect fair. And I thought, well, okay, I'll go check it out. And the thing freaking exploded right on my lap. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, it's a hard sell to get people to maybe be sympathetic to the dung beetle, but, but you know, butterflies, everybody I think sees the beauty and, you know, just how magnificent they are when they morph. And so that's a story even children, I think, would resonate, that this person is going to poach these animals, and whether they stay alive or not, he's going to sell them.
Right. And you know what? That's a great perspective, because that was my perspective coming into it, probably like yours and many of your listeners. Our experience with butterflies is as kids running around with nets, catching, you know, swallowtails or whatever, and letting them go. Or maybe we had a little butterfly collection as kids. I didn't, but, you know, a lot of kids did. And I never, you know, you don't think of insects as something that might be endangered or in need of protection, because they're just everywhere. Normally you're shooing them away more than anything else. But as I got into this case, I realized that there are a lot of insects around the world that are critically endangered, listed as threatened or endangered under the U.S. Endangered Species Act, protected by international treaty known as CITES, which is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. And as I thought about it, I thought, you know, if an insect is endangered, almost extinct, what do you think's happening with the other animals in that ecosystem, right? So I'm telling you, if a birdwing butterfly in Indonesia is struggling to maintain its, you know, species, I guarantee you the tigers that live in that jungle are having a problem. The rhinos that are in that jungle are having a problem. Every animal there is having a problem.
They're all connected.
Yeah, for sure. No doubt.
Yeah. So it'll start with the frogs and lizards, and then it'll move to whatever eats them and whatever eats them. And
yeah,
that's what happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's another aspect to this case you're working, though. When you're looking at this thing internationally and you're seeing how he goes to these different continents and he gets these different butterflies and the way he sells them, there's this web of criminality that he has got to be a little shocking to you.
Yes. And that was very shocking. As I got to know, so the way this rolled out was, the plan was we had an informant that was going to go to the bug fair and make some contacts with Kojima and just kind of get a feel for what he was up to. And maybe we'd get lucky and he'd admit to doing something illegal. And my job was really just to manage the informant, help him operate his undercover equipment, his recording equipment, and, you know, make sure he was safe. You know, we didn't think Yoshi Kojima was dangerous, and this was at a public event, so nothing was going to happen. But nonetheless, you have an agent there. And this poor guy, during the whole day, Yoshi just really wouldn't talk to him. Anyway, so at the end of the day, I kind of got frustrated, and I thought, well, what the hell? I'm just going to walk up and talk to Yoshi Kojima myself. Because I was there plain clothes. He didn't know who I was. So I, you know, played myself off as a novice, asked him a lot of questions about what he was selling, which of course were all legal. But that kickstarted this relationship that I built in an undercover capacity with Kojima that lasted about 3 years. And took me 3 years to make a case against him, because as I learned, he was extremely paranoid. He had a heavy Japanese accent, so he had trouble pronouncing fish and wildlife. So he would often tell me, I mean, he had no idea I worked for Fish and Wildlife, but he would often tell me that I had to watch out and be careful because the Fish and Wild guys were out there. And he always called us the Fish and Wild guys. And he had known that John Mendoza was after him years before. And he bragged about how he outsmarted Special Agent John Mendoza with the Fish and Wild guys. And that really annoyed me, and it put the emphasis in, I guess, the fire under me to make sure that I didn't allow somebody to think that they pulled one over on the Fish and Wild guys.
After 3 years, you finally got a break. Somebody called in a tip. Tell us who the person was, if you know, that called in talking about a Ted Nelson.
Well, I got to be honest with you. This was not a break. This was actually the second time that I thought I had completely driven this case right into the ground. You know, I was a new agent, and all around me, all my fellow agents were basically killing it. They were making case after case. And here I am. I got this big opportunity. And Yoshi Kojima was a difficult person to work undercover. I always described him as like a junior high school boyfriend or girlfriend. If you were not available when he called or he wanted your attention, he would stop talking to me for weeks at a time. And it was frustrating. And yeah, there were a couple times there where he just would kind of cut me off and I'd think, oh boy, this case is over. And let me back up a little bit before I get to this tip you mentioned. Ultimately, after that, I introduced myself to him at that bug fair. He took a liking to me. And he actually, at the end of the day, he gave me a gift of some really, you know, worthless dried butterflies. And to be clear for your listeners, these are not live butterflies. They're captured out in the wild. Usually what they do is they capture the caterpillars. They bring the caterpillars in just like you would as a kid. You put them in aquariums or tanks and they let them cocoon. As soon as they hatch, they kill them because now their wings are in perfect condition. And then they're mounted. They're pinned in a box, kind of like what you'd see at a museum. And that's how they're valuable. They're sold pinned. And so he gave me a box of pinned dried butterflies that weren't valuable, just as a gift. And this kind of sparked off this 3-year relationship where ultimately he started to invite me to go to lunch, dinner, go out for coffee. And he very carefully groomed me to become a business partner with him. And his idea was he was going to send me butterflies from Japan that I would then facilitate selling online to various collectors. And it was real clear, all of us in the office, we knew, okay, well, Kojima's, and by the way, my undercover name was Ted Nelson. And it was clear to us, okay, Kojima's setting me up to take the fall. He's going to set up this business. And if Fish and Wild guys come calling, he'll feed them Ted Nelson and he'll walk away and slink off in the background. So we knew that was happening, but it didn't really matter because our hope was, okay, he's going to send us some protected butterflies and hope that Ted Nelson can sell them. But he wasn't. He wouldn't send me anything. So between all this junior high school behavior of not talking to me for weeks and not sending me anything, but promising to, I decided, being a young, new creative thinking agent, I said, hey, I'm going to lure this guy back by creating my own. I'm going to start selling I'm going to create a situation that looks like I'm selling butterflies on eBay. I'm not really going to sell them. I'm just going to create a fake eBay account. And so the idea, of course, as you can imagine, is he will go call me and say, hey, Ted, where are you getting these? I can supply you with better material for less money. Well, smart, I thought. But what happened was he started to see me as a competitor and he started to get mad at me. And I tried to reassure him. I was like, hey, you know, you just weren't sending anything. And so I had to find somebody else and I'd rather work with you. But he wasn't having it. And he was getting more and more angry. And I was getting more and more panicked that the relationship was crashing and burning. And this culminated in this tip you mentioned. Now we come back to this tip. One day, I get a phone call from a California state game warden who monitors their tip line, California State Fish and Wildlife, which is the state agency that, you know, does enforce the state wildlife laws. They have a tip line that you can call that's 1-800 number. And one day, this game warden checks, and there's this heavy Japanese-accented caller who is reporting Ted Nelson for illegally selling butterflies on eBay. And so I ask him to send me the tape and we all listen to it at my office and everybody, all the agents in the office were like, oh boy, Ed, you're never going to get Kojima now, because now that he's turned you in, if you stay in the business, he's going to assume that you have been flipped as an informant. He's never going to trust you. So I thought, oh, okay, well, case is over. I screwed this case up and I kind of ignored it for a while. And that was this big tip that came in. It didn't help us at all. It actually really hurt us because here our bad guy is turning in the undercover agent.
Yeah.
Not kids.
That is wicked.
Yeah, it wasn't good. And, you know, I had learned during this time, this is probably 2 years in, I had learned that Kojima had this massive network of people around the world who he paid to collect insects, mostly butterflies, but also some beetles all over the world. He'd take advantage of local people. He'd basically recruit them to collect stuff. They had no idea what they were collecting. They didn't know it was worth, you know, they had a butterfly that was worth $10,000. They just knew they were going to get paid $100 from Kojima for collecting it. And as a result of this huge network, he could pretty much get any insect you wanted. So if you were interested in one of the most endangered butterflies in the world, let's say the Ornithoptera alexandria, which is one of the biggest butterfly in the world, it's about 12 inches across wingspan and highly endangered, he could get it. And, you know, universities and museums can't even get those specimens for their, you know, scientific collections. So I realized this guy was an important player, and here I had screwed the case up. So much for that great introduction you just gave me, right? Here's this great agent that basically screwed up this case.
Anyway, Ed, thanks for coming. That's the end of Zone 7.
One of your best episodes ever.
But here's the thing, and this is what I want, you know, young investigators listening to this show to think about. Change the word butterfly to heroin. It could still take you 3 years with a heavy hitter. You could think you've ruined it multiple times. Stay in the game. Keep playing, because it's going to possibly work out. And if not, you're still going to learn something you can use on the next case. So keep telling us what happened. Now everybody thinks, oh, well, Ed, that's over.
You know, that is actually a very good kind of teaching moment, right? You're absolutely right. And it is a good lesson for young investigators, because I certainly had this feeling of being a little depressed that this case was over. I was a little worried that I had, you know, been burned or whatever. And I think a lot of new agents in particular, the first time they do undercover work, they think they're at every moment, they think they're burned, and the people know that they're cops. So what I did, my boss actually suggested, she said, why don't you close this case? And I kind of said, no, I kind of begged her to let me keep it open. So I didn't really work on the Kojima case for a few months, but I kind of just kept it on the corner of my desk. And I started to work on other things. Honestly, I picked up other cases. I started to work on another pretty detailed undercover case. And lo and behold, out of nowhere, you know, Kojima had kind of disappeared from the U.S. after that. He wasn't coming to the bug fair anymore. He was still dealing. We knew that, but, you know, nobody was really seeing him. And lo and behold, about a year and a half later, maybe a year later, I get just a random phone call from somebody in the insect business, a legitimate dealer, who says, hey, I heard a rumor that Kojima's coming back to the insect fair in May, which was May 2006. And I said to my boss, I said, you know what? I'm going to give this one more shot. And I cooked up this plan where I would go to the fair, I'd find him, and then I'd just hope for the best and try to manufacture an accidental encounter with the guy and see what happened. I had a plan for what I would say and how things would go, because, you know, he knows he turned me in. He's got to be wondering if I know he turned me in. So I found him. I went to the fair that year and I found him. It was pretty easy. He's a unique character. Yoshi Kojima was a funny guy. He was in his mid-50s then. He always wore cargo shorts, a Hawaiian shirt, and a fanny pack that was adjusted to the front. And he kind of had thinning hair that he didn't comb very often. And the funny thing is, in that fanny pack, if any crook in L.A. had known that this little Japanese man was walking around with $10,000 cash in his fanny pack.
100%.
Oh, I can't believe the guy never got robbed in L.A., but he carried a lot of cash in his fanny pack. So I saw him, and I knew that there were two main halls in the museum where they were displaying all these insects that were being sold. And these insect fairs are really crazy to go to if anybody ever has a chance to visit one. They're open to the public, and there's a lot of just regular, you know, Janes and Joes in there with their kids looking at insects that are very common, maybe sold for a dollar or two to be pinned in a collection. But then there are also these heavy duty collectors, and they're in there looking for the insects that are being, you know, sold for $500,000-$600,000 a piece for, you know, collections. So Kojima kind of moved in those circles, but I knew that he was going to have to move from one of the exhibit halls to the other through a pretty narrow walkway. So I just kind of hung out in there until I saw him coming. And then I made it look like I was walking the other direction. And sure enough, he saw me. I saw him. I feigned surprise. He looked genuinely surprised. And he looked nervous. He looked scared. Like, he was afraid of me for some reason. Probably because he thought I knew he had turned me in.
Yeah, maybe somebody paid you a visit.
Yeah, exactly. So I made the initial approach, and I kind of open arms, big smile on my face. You know, acted so happy to see him. And one of the very first things I said to him, which was something I had planned out pretty carefully, was I thanked him. And I said, I owe you a huge debt. And he kind of, you know, looked at me in a puzzled way. And I said, look, some a-hole turned me in to the Fish and Wild guys. And these agents showed up at my house and they tried to search my place. But thank you for the advice you gave me years ago. They didn't find a damn thing. They couldn't make a case against me. And thanks to you, Yoshi, I'm not in jail. And well, I'll tell you what, he fell for it hook, line, and sinker. He loved it. He loved that, because he always valued that role as the mentor, right? And he loved it. And the first thing he said to me was, well, are you still selling? And I said, oh, yeah, I am. But I have a horrible supplier. I just made up something. I said, I have a guy out of Germany who's supplying me. He keeps sending me butterflies with broken wings and no antenna. And Yoshi, he bit and he said, let's have lunch. And he took me to lunch that day, and he outlined his ability to send me whatever I wanted, basically. And that was a turning point in the case. He now believed that I was a true criminal because he knew he had turned me in. He believed my story when I told him that Fish and Wild guys had come to see me, because that's what happened to him back when John Mendoza was looking at him. And now we were pals. And we made a list right there at the table at this restaurant we went to of the various butterflies I was interested in, what he could sell them to me for. And he said, okay, I'll tell you what, I'm going to go back to Japan. This was mid-2000s, so Skype was fairly new as a web communication tool. He said, let's get on Skype. I can show you what I've got in Japan, and you tell me if you want it, and I'll send it to you. So here I walk away from this reinvigorated relationship, and Yoshi's telling me he's going to be in his home in Japan. He's going to show me protected butterflies on a camera that I can record. And he's going to tell me, here's how I'm going to smuggle it into the United States. Here's how much you're going to pay for it. I mean, if this happens, I make my case, right?
He gave you every element you need.
Exactly. I mean, if this worked, this was going to sink him, right? This was something that was really pretty amazing, and we were all pretty stoked about it at the office when this unfolded. And that's exactly what happened. He went back to Japan, and for the next few months, just about every night, because he lived in Kyoto, Japan, and he was about 10 hours, something like that, ahead of Los Angeles. So he would want to talk during his daytime, my nighttime. So between like 10 p.m. and 2 a.m., I'd be on a Skype call just about every night with Kojima. And this guy did exactly what I just outlined. Let me give you an example. One time, he offered to sell me what are known as Papilio hospiton butterflies, which they're only found in Corsica, and they're very endangered. They're on the U.S. endangered species list. And he offered to send me two pairs, male and female pairs, so I'd get four butterflies. And on a Skype call, he, in a very detailed explanation, he explained to me, okay, it's going to cost you, whatever it was, $2,000 or $3,000 for these. And I'm going to smuggle them in a way, I mean, even use those words. I'm going to smuggle them in a package along with this other species that looks a lot like them. And I'm going to basically declare them as this unprotected species that's very similar looking. And by the way, if you see a female mark on one, if a female mark with the number one next to it, that's going to be a male hospitant. It was a complicated smuggling scheme, but he outlined it for me on the Skype call, which I recorded. And then those butterflies arrive, and that was one count of smuggling that was ironclad against Yoshi Kojima. And that went on for months. During the months that we had these Skype calls, he offered to sell me butterflies valued at more than $300,000. Now, of course, I didn't have that kind of undercover money to spend. I had about $30,000, which even my bosses didn't want me to spend that. I ended up spending about $18,000, but I was very careful what I bought from him. And I bought butterflies that were, you know, protected that, from different parts of the world that would show his scope and his reach and the severity of, you know, what he was doing. And after we made a plan, okay, after you get this many and these particular species, we're going to indict him. And we did that. After about 3-4 months, I was able to go to a grand jury, present the case to a U.S. attorney. We took it to a grand jury in federal court, and they indicted Kojima on 17 counts of trafficking in endangered species. You know, here's another crazy side story about this. One time I asked him, I didn't actually expect him to be able to supply me with some of the most endangered stuff. One time I asked him, I said, hey, I do have a customer that's interested in the Ornithoptera alexandria, the biggest butterfly in the world that museums and universities can't get. And I said, do you think you could get one of those? And he said, it'll take me a couple of weeks, but yeah, I can do it. Sure as heck, I paid him for it. And a few weeks later, he smuggled it into the U.S. for me using international mail. But now, of course, Cheryl, we got a problem. He's in Japan, right?
That's right. That's right.
So we got an arrest warrant for him. We've got a 17-count federal indictment, but now we got to get our hands on him. So there's two ways we can do that. We can extradite him, which is a very long process, very difficult, very labor intensive. Or we know he comes to the States. So in my mind, I thought, well, if he comes here on his own volition, we can just hook him up when he arrives at the airport. So I thought, well, there's got to be a way to get him here. And one way presented itself very early in this relationship. So at the beginning, in the first year and a half or so, Kojima was just, he was friendly with me. He was a little standoffish. He was very paranoid. Like, he used to sometimes, in the middle of a conversation, he'd be like, so how long have you been with the Fish and Wildlife Service? You know, and just trying to trip me up. At one time, after we met for coffee, he very carefully examined my vehicle. You know, he was looking in the grill, looking at the license plate, peering in the windows. And I was like, Yoshi, what are you doing? And he saw, I'm looking for the, police lights in the grill of your car. Make sure you, and I'm like, come on, Yoshi. I don't even know what Fish and Wildlife is. And so at the beginning, he was paranoid. But at the end, he was very friendly with me. And I realized he had, I think Kojima was probably bisexual. And he had developed some type of serious attraction to me. And it might have had something to do with the fact that I had grown this huge biker mustache for the other undercover case I was working on.
He really, use what you got, Chilga. Yeah, use what you got.
That's right. So it was awkward because he would sometimes make very suggestive statements to me on these recorded Skype calls, you know, like wanting me to take my shirt off. And you can't do that. I mean, you're an undercover agent. You can't take your shirt off for a suspect. You just can't engage in that kind of thing. So I had to very carefully play it off, you know, without offending him. Because remember, he's like a junior high school boyfriend or girlfriend. He might stop talking to me if I offend him. So I kept playing him off. But at the end, when we had this arrest warrant, I realized, okay, this is it. I gotta play curious here. And the next time he started to make suggestive comments to me, I played it off like, you know, you're wearing me down, Yoshi. You're such a great guy. I'm curious. I'll tell you what, next time you come to LA, we'll go on a date. And don't you know, like 48 hours later, this guy booked a flight to Los Angeles.
Wow.
And he arrived in LA and it was like straight out of the movies. He was taken into custody without incident. We arrested him at the airport and we had him.
Unbelievable. And I want to tell you something else. Here's another little piece of advice, and I hope that the young investigators are listening, because you said something really important in the beginning. You wanted the tiger case. You want the polar bear case. You're given a butterfly case. But you didn't just half work it, and when we're given the opportunity to close it, took it. You did not. You stayed with that case, and the work that you were able to do, I mean, that's what legends are made of. That's why the U.S. attorney keeps giving you awards, because what you're able to do, I mean, you worked that thing like it was heroin.
Yeah. And honestly, that was my very first law enforcement award from the U.S. attorney's office, was for the work I did on the Kojima case. And it did open my eyes to the importance of all the other species. Working on a tiger cub smuggling case is sexy and fun and gets a lot of media attention. Protecting wolves, grizzly bears is important and fun. But there's a lot of animals and wildlife and nature out there that has no voice and nobody's sticking up for it. And it kind of opened my eyes to the scope of our job and the importance of our job. I don't like criminals. I wasn't going to let Yoshi Kojima get away. And I really didn't like the fact that he thought he had outsmarted one of our agents. So that was another thing.
That's good all day.
Yeah, the agency pride goes a long way, right?
Amen. That goes a long way. And that's good for everybody. And one thing, too, I want to mention, y'all, when you're talking about these organized criminals, human trafficking plays a role, too. So when you're talking about a butterfly or a tiger or a black bear, you can, again, exchange that for a 5-year-old boy, 17-year-old girl, 36-year-old woman. They can get people using the same routes that these smugglers use.
Absolutely. Yeah, investigation is investigation and crime is crime. This isn't directly what you're referring to, but, you know, a lot of times, once a smuggler has the systems and the routes in place, they will engage in other types of crimes. You know, if you can smuggle butterflies into the U.S., you can also smuggle drugs, or you can smuggle people.
Well, look at pimps. Pimps are going to run women. They're going to run drugs. They're going to run guns.
Absolutely. It's opportunity.
And, you know, after you had your butterfly case, you moved right into the fish smuggling. And here's what's so funny. I have a buddy that works for Black River Caviar. And we were having a conversation because she had somebody sort of famous say to her they prefer wild caviar. And she said, well, if you've ever had wild caviar, you've had black market caviar.
Absolutely.
You're not supposed to have caviar that didn't come from a farm because sturgeon are endangered.
Mm-hmm. Many species of them are, yeah. Some of them critically.
Well, tell us about your fish case.
Oh, my gosh. You know, here I'm still waiting for my tiger case, right?
Right.
Not long after the Kojima case, I picked up this interesting fish case. And then this is going to require a little bit of explanation about the law. But I think given some of your points about, you know, maybe some of the lessons we can all learn from different investigators' experiences, these fish cases can be really complicated and very, very lucrative for the people involved. There's a fish known as the Asian arowana. It's not the marijuana, it's the arowana. It's an interesting fish. It's found throughout Asia, Southeast Asia, Indonesia, South Asia. And it is a predatory fish that can get pretty big, maybe like 2.5 feet when it's a mature adult. They have an upturned mouth, which is really interesting, and they're what are called mouth brooders. So when their eggs hatch, all of the baby fish will hang around mama because mama's a tough, you know, SOB, and she will defend her clutch of fish, a baby fish. And if there's a threat, they all run into her. She'll open her mouth, and they all swim into her mouth. And she kind of hides them in her mouth. And that's what they call mouth brooders, is the ones that they're very interesting fish, but they're aggressive. They'll protect their territory. And that becomes important later in this story. So the way the law is for Asian arowana, under the U.S. Endangered Species Act, they are listed as endangered. But under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, which is the international treaty regarding the movement of wild animals, they have dual protection. If they're wild, they're listed as Appendix 1, which means they cannot be traded in the trade. If they're raised in captivity, they're listed as what's called Appendix 2, which means they can be sold internationally and shipped internationally if they have a CITES export permit from the country of origin. And most of them come out of Indonesia. Now, the reason this is important is because anytime you have a scheme like that, a legal scheme like that, it creates an opportunity to launder fish. So all you have to do is catch your wild fish and make it look like it was raised in captivity, and bing, bang, boom, you get your permit and it appears to be legal. And during this next investigation I'm going to talk about, I was able to uncover really the insidious side of the Asian arowana trade. There is a lot of laundering of these fish going on. They're a really cool fish. They're unusual. And the fact that they're being depleted from the wild under the guise of having been captive raised is really, like, it's sinister. It's almost sinister, right? And it really shows that the people involved are greedy. They're interested in money. They don't care about even their own environment, which to me is just repulsive.
So these fish go for about $5,000.
Yeah, depending on size. Now, normally to ship them, you know, and have them live, they're going to have to be fairly small, because to smuggle them, you have to have these. Now, unlike the butterflies, these fish are only valuable if they're alive. And the reason they're so valuable is there's many cultures in the world that believe that Asian arowanas bring good luck. And they come in these crazy color patterns. Like, there might be one that looks like a gold bar, and then another one will be like bright red. It's all the same species. It's just like different morphs. So you could have a small fish that's maybe 4 or 5 inches in length that would sell between $1,500 and $5,000 from the initial sale from the provider. If the fish starts to get bigger and it's maybe 12 to 20 inches, it could easily go for $10,000 or more. During my investigation of this Asian arowana case we're going to talk about, which I called Operation RTG, there was a report of one fish being sold for $30,000, just one live fish. As you can imagine, that kind of money will draw criminal enterprises right to it. I called this case RTG because one of the codes that's often used in the criminal networks is for an Asian arowana is RTG, and that stands for Red Tail Golden. And it's a particular morph of a Asian arowana. They also sometimes use a code name like Dragonfish, or they might use SR, which stands for Super Red. But the way this started for me, and I think this is the lesson for younger or up and coming or people, you know, investigators or people who want to get into law enforcement and do investigations. Always pay attention to those, like, be available to talk to the public. Pay attention to those phone calls that come into the office, and don't sit around in the office waiting for your supervisor to assign a case to you. Our saying in Los Angeles, you know, like I said, we had hard charging agents in Los Angeles. We were one of the busiest field offices in the country. If an agent was waiting for a supervisor to assign a case to them, our view as agents was, that agent is kind of mediocre, right? They're not working very hard, because you shouldn't have to wait around for your supervisor to assign something if you're networked in. So that's how this case came to me. I was kind of obsessed with talking to the public and taking phone calls from the public. And if somebody walked in our front door and they wanted to talk to an agent, I'd sit down and talk to them. And one of the things that came up for me was I used to skulk around, for lack of a better word, I used to snoop around on these various bulletin boards and chat rooms on websites that attracted people who were into really exotic fish. And one of those places is called aquaticpredators.com. I don't know if they're still around, but they were in the mid-2000s. So I used to just routinely, if I had nothing else going on, I had an undercover email account, and I would log into aquaticpredators.com. And I just start snooping around in the bulletin boards and see what people were talking about. And one day I come across this posting by a guy named Andre Ramza. And he's just basically making this very nonchalant inquiry about whether or not anyone in the U.S. knows how to get RTGs into the U.S. And I immediately recognized that RTG was, you know, a code name for Asian arowana. And my thinking was, I need to reach out to this guy because I don't know how many thousands of people are seeing this post, right? So I'm going to try to intercept this. I'm going to try to be the guy this guy's talking to rather than somebody else in the U.S. who might actually be a smuggler. So I reached out to him, and I find out basically in a short while, few exchanges, that he's based out of Indonesia, which is one of the places Asian arowanas are found. And he tells me he's got a friend in San Diego and he wants to send him to Asian arowanas, but he knows it's illegal and he's not sure how to do it. So he's passing it off like he's not selling it. He's just sending it as a gift to a friend. And I said, now, interesting, Cheryl, some of your listeners might say, hey, isn't newcomer about to entrap this guy? And so maybe it's worthwhile to just give a 2-second primer on what entrapment is. And, you know, for your listeners, if they don't know, entrapment means that, you know, law enforcement basically creates the opportunity and gives the person the idea to commit the crime when they wouldn't have had the idea on their own or the opportunity on their own. And basically, all you need to do as a law enforcement officer to get past a defense of entrapment is provide what the law or the courts refer to as a scintilla of evidence that they were predisposed. And a scintilla is not defined in the law, but we all know a scintilla is very little.
It ain't much.
It ain't much. Those are exact words I was about to use. It ain't much. And so, you know, already this Andre Ramza guy has already presented to me predisposition. He's told me he wants to send RTGs to the U.S. and he's having trouble because it's illegal. So it's already this until it's there, but there's a few more things I can do to kind of shore that up as we go along. But basically I told him, hey, I'm having the same problem. It's hard to get things past customs, but I have an idea. And that's all I said. And then I let him make the next step. And he did. He wanted to know what my idea was. And I thought, well, I'm going to see what he's up to. So I basically presented a scenario to him that I had a friend who worked for U.S. Customs who could help me get things through unnoticed. And this is a guy in Indonesia, a country where I know there's a lot of corruption. So it would not be unusual for him to believe that story. I mean, as far as in his world, corruption is common. So he bit. And he immediately started talking to me about my plan and how he would do it. And this quickly morphed into I actually made some notes in preparation of our recording today. And I realized that my first contact with him was on May 3rd. Between May 6th and May 8th, he started to introduce me to not just a friend in San Diego, but 17 customers in the United States he had kind of, you know, fostered who were very interested in purchasing Asian arowana fish from him. Yeah. So this was not a guy who was sending fish as gifts. This was a guy who was engaged in the business of selling Asian arowana. So we knew we had a case. And what I did was I basically explained this plan, not only to him, but also to all of his customers, because they started to call my undercover cell phone and ask me, how are you going to do this? And what I was very careful to do with every single customer that called me or potential customer, I said, hey, I said, you're not a cop, are you? Because this is illegal, right? And I would basically get them to tell me what the law was. And every single person I talked to who was a potential customer of Andre was very aware of the Endangered Species Act, very aware that Asian arowanas were not legal to import into the United States, even if captive bred. And they wanted them. And these guys were talking about paying between $500 and $3,000 a fish, depending on the size they were getting. And they wanted reassurance from me that I could get the fish in illegally without getting caught. This case really unfolded quickly. Like I said, by, you know, early May, I had been contact with 17 people who wanted this to happen. And by June 22nd, Andre's basically making plans to send the first two fish as a test because he wanted to see if this scheme would work, right? So I worked with U.S. Customs and Homeland Security as well, investigations, and Andre sent the shipment. And by this time, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has an intelligence unit, and they were able to decipher that Andre's last name was actually Gunawan rather than Ramza. So he was using a fake name. So we identified him as a guy named Andre Gunawan out of Bogor, Indonesia. And he decided he was going to send two fish first as a test. He did. He sent them to Ted Nelson again, was my undercover name. I received those fish at LAX through Korea Air and I took pictures and emailed back and said, hey, your fish arrived. Everything's good. We knew that he wanted to ship more, so we didn't want to take the case down yet. So we actually delivered those two fish to his first two customers. In one instance, me and another agent drove to San Diego and personally delivered the fish to a guy named Sam in San Diego. And during that meeting, Sam, like, literally, I think the quote in one of my reports was, "Phew, I'm so glad you're not a federal agent because I wasn't sure we were going to get these fish through." and then he goes on to explain the law to me. And I was like, you know, the whole thing's recorded. It doesn't get better than that when the bad guy's telling you what the law is.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it was fun.
Fantastic.
And then the other fish we shipped to a guy and this guy actually becomes important later in this story, but we shipped the other fish via FedEx to another guy in Kentucky. And we alerted, this is the great thing about being a federal agent, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We have agents all over the country, right? So I alerted the agents in Kentucky. We actually had agents doing surveillance on the house who observed the FedEx driver deliver this package that I had sent and actually, you know, observed our suspect in Kentucky receive the package at his front door. So we knew in anticipation of future search warrants that the fish went into that house and that suspect, you know, X, a guy named Lee, picked up the fish. The great news is Ed Andre sends out an email to all these 17 customers. Success. It worked. Our scheme worked. And this got us past the hump of all suspicion. There was a guy with the last name Koo in Texas who had been warning people, hey, I think this Ted Nelson guy is a U.S. customs agent. So he didn't want to order. He was supposed to order on that first shipment. And he was like, I'm not doing it because I think Ted's a Fed. And once the shipment went through, all of a sudden, Tom Koo was his name. He put his orders in because now he was convinced this was a legit deal.
Ah. Oh.
Yeah.
Well, now, that was kind of a coup itself.
Exactly. A coup right on the bad guys. So, yeah, very quickly after that. So now this is into July. This is happening by late August. Andre Gunawan makes arrangements to send 12 more fish to the U.S. So now we kind of have a dilemma because these are endangered fish. We suspect they're coming from the wild. We don't think they're coming from captive breeding facilities. And basically we can't let this go on too long. We want to catch the people involved. We don't want to just have two people we catch. We want to, you know, take down Andre. We want to take down this customer base, but we can't let, you know, the endangered fish trade go on because we are trying to protect these animals. So we decide, okay, we're going to do this next shipment and then we're going to take everybody down. And sure enough, end of August rolls around and the next shipment of 10 fish comes in. And we arranged to make a personal delivery to the people in LA. And I tell them all of the customers in LA need to meet me at the Target parking lot in Carson, California. And I said, I'm delivering them in person because I'm afraid, you know, I don't want them to die, blah, blah, blah. So sure enough, all of the people that had lived in the LA area who were customers showed up at Target, and we had a massive team of Fish and Wildlife Special Agents and Homeland Security special agents stationed around the parking lot. We had a surveillance van sitting in the middle of the parking lot watching everybody. And I met as Ted Nelson at the back of my undercover vehicle with these customers. I showed them the VISH. Everything's recorded. I had them actually sign a document saying they'd received it. it was beautiful. And then the coup de grace was something I didn't expect. Everybody was so giddy and happy that they were receiving these valuable endangered fish. We all agreed to pose for a photograph at the back of my vehicle together. So I remember later my boss was like, I saw you posing for the photo. And I was like, what in the hell is he doing?
But I can tell you that is State's Exhibit A1.
Exactly. And what I really wanted was I wanted them to be holding their fish in the bag. And I said to him, I said, hey, why don't you guys hold your fish for the photo? And on the mic, you know, I'm recording everything. One of the guys says, hell no, I'm not going to hold an illegal fish while I'm in a photograph. Now, that's Exhibit B.
Just right? Got better.
It just got better.
Yeah. I bet that prosecutor, I mean, you want to talk about dancing. Now, I have to ask one question about the photo.
Sure.
Was your shirt on or off?
Fully clothed.
Oh, well, we don't care about that. Move on.
Yeah. But I did have the fancy big mustache. That helps.
Oh, right on. Okay.
So that this is what we call a deliver bust in the law enforcement world. You're familiar with those, Cheryl. When everything's done, I gave the signal and I walked away, and in come the lights and sirens and the agents in their tactical gear, and everybody got arrested. Now, the funny thing was, we made it look like I got arrested as well. And the thing that really cracked me up is later that night, I was back at the office, everybody had been processed. And I got an email from one of the guys who lived outside of LA, and the word had gotten out there had been an arrest, because he sent me an email to Ted Nelson saying he'd reconsidered and he'd like to cancel his order. And I didn't even answer the email because I was like, too late. You're already under indictment, you know?
God, so nice try.
Nice try. As a result of this, we indicted. We didn't get all 17 of the customers that were originally on the list, but we'd indicted 7 people. And every single one of them was indicted for a felony. And every single one of them, once they saw the evidence we had against them between email correspondence, recorded undercover phone calls, recorded in-person meetings. I forgot to mention, some of these guys were so paranoid about me, they wanted to meet beforehand. So we had some in-person meetings in LA where I'd meet with them with another undercover agent posing as my girlfriend or whatever. And I'd reassure them, yeah, I'm a regular guy. And they'd walk away satisfied. There was no defeating the evidence that we had. And every single one of those 7 people, with the exception of Gunawan, pleaded guilty. And they were all sentenced. They all have felonies on their record. They had pretty significant fines. They weren't sent to jail. They had long probations, 2 to 3 year probation periods. And we never saw them ever engaged in anything like this ever again. The fun thing was about this guy, Lee, in Kentucky. One of the things we wanted to do was we wanted to recover those 2 fish we'd already delivered. So we had agents in San Diego and Kentucky execute search warrants at those houses. And luckily, we were able to recover those 2 fish. They were still at the house. But during that search warrant in Kentucky, the agents interviewed the guy named Lee. And Lee acted like he was cooperating, but he lied. He said he wasn't sure who the guy was in LA, which would have been Ted Nelson. He gave a different name for Andre Gunawan. He basically tried to misdirect our agents at every opportunity, which is another federal crime. You cannot lie to a federal agent. You don't have to talk to a federal agent, but if you do, as Martha Stewart, Marion Jones, and many others have learned, if you do talk to a federal agent and you lie, that's a felony. So later that night, after our agents in Kentucky had conducted a search warrant at his house and interviewed him, he actually called me, Ted Nelson, on my undercover phone and told me, hey, Ted, watch out. The Fish and Wildlife Service is after you. They were at my house today. They did a search warrant. They seized the fish. They're coming for you. Don't worry. I lied and told them all these stories about, you know, different, I gave them different names, different information.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And of course, that's all recorded too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the moral of the story is, we shut them down. We shut down on, and we stopped something that could have, if an agent hadn't seen that original post by Andre, somebody else would have picked it up. Somebody else would have helped him do the smuggling scheme and they would have gotten away with it.
And that, again, is the lesson, because if they can get a fish into this country, they can get a weapon.
Absolutely.
And I think that's another brilliant move when you bring in Homeland Security and everybody else to show them from a chat room, this is where we got to. San Diego, Kentucky, et cetera. Now, I do have one question. When you got the fish back, where do they go?
And that's another important thing. When you're a Fish and Wildlife Special Agent, your evidence is often alive and requires care, feeding, and you have to find a home for it, right? You don't want it to get back into the market. It can't go back to Indonesia because you don't know where it came from, and it can't be reintroduced or put back in the wild because it might introduce a disease. So the good news is we recovered. We had all 12 fish. They all lived, and they were all transferred to the Pittsburgh Zoo, which, of course, is an accredited zoo under the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. And they went to the, they became an educational exhibit at the Pittsburgh Zoo. So as far as I was concerned as an agent, that's a good result.
That's outstanding. And I tell you, you know, I run the Wildlife CSI Academy, which you and I have talked about. And just the idea that now they are a teaching tool is, to me, a tremendous ending.
That's one of the things, whenever I donated, you know, seized animals to a facility like that, I couldn't force them to do it, but I always encourage them to include some type of educational placard to let the public know that these animals were recovered during a criminal wildlife trafficking investigation, just so people know, you know, these things are, they're not, they're expendable, right?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Ed Newcomer, I cannot thank you enough for coming on to Zone 7, for being just a phone call away if we have a situation with an animal that we need help with, and your career speaks for itself.
Well, you know what? Thank you for having me on. And if you don't mind, I'll make one more plug for my podcast. And in the podcast, I'm not telling my stories. I'm interviewing other agents and state wildlife officers who have similar, really great stories from their careers. So anybody who's interested in this kind of true crime, don't feel like you're going to hear the newcomer story when you tune in to Nature Secret Service, because you're going to hear some awesome stories from some awesome federal and state officers who work on wildlife crime.
Love it. Nature Secret Service, y'all get to it. The stories, you will not believe what is going on in the wildlife arena. I'm just telling you, you won't believe it. But Ed, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Cheryl. It's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed it, and I hope we can do it again sometime.
I'm going to end Zone 7 the way that I always do, with a quote. And I want y'all to think about Ed's mustache, because it was the inspiration for this quote. My dad worked for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and he worked for the Department of the Interior, you know, like the federal government. And consequently, I spent a lot of time outdoors in my life. I even became the voice of Smokey the Bear, Sam Elliott. I'm Cheryl McCollum, and this is Zone 7.
You're listening to an iHeart podcast.